Wisconsin Conversation, real information. Live from Lake Wissota, this is Up North News with Pat Kreitlow.
Hey, happy Monday. It's the third hour of Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Luke Mathers is our producer and guy who makes all things happen, especially when it comes to how things sound good. He even makes me sound good sometimes. Don't hold it against him. The third hour, of course, is where we normally realize that it's getting close to lunchtime and we're hungry. So our coffee break is kind of evolving into lunch hour preparations. Let me tell you what I wish I could have after yesterday's less than stellar experience over in the Twin Cities, where we made this, you know, annual end of summer, you know, shopping trip and things like that, visited friends. So I wanted to see a baseball game. I haven't been to American Family Field yet this year. I'm going at least once next month to a game. So I haven't been to a Brewers game yet, but I did go see a Twins game at Target Field. It was a beautiful day for it. Again, they still should have a retractable roof anyway, but they don't. But so we happen to enjoy one of the few really nice days for outdoor baseball. First get there, and I've been to Target Field before. It's been a few years now, you know, with the pandemic and everything. But I was looking forward to, you know, the ballpark food. All these ballparks are getting known to have better food choices all the time. So I was sure that there was going to be something good. I passed by a food stand and I see, you know, brats are listed, and that hits me right away. Like, yeah, brat, I would like a brat. So I order one, and what I get is something more along the lines of a Polish sausage. And I thought, okay, well, that's fine. It's not exactly what I was hoping for, but okay, I'll throw some sauerkraut on this. I'll be fine. Cause at American Family Field, you're going to get sauerkraut. There's some there right next to the ketchup and the mustard and everything else. There's none there. There's no kraut there. Just ketchup and mustard and relish, just the basics, as if all they're still selling are Schweigert hot dogs, the way they did back when Harmon Killebrew and Rod Carew were playing at Metropolitan Stadium. No kraut. So, okay, fine. We're going to treat this like a, you know, an oversized hot dog. We'll put some ketchup on there. And, you know, I feel like I'm really, they're going to take away my Wisconsin card for this. But then one of my friends notes, they saw a stand with actual brats, and they had grilled onions and sauerkraut on the griddle. But it's a standalone cart. You got to walk a little ways to get it. Great. Okay, fine. I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, kind of a pig here, but I've been to picnics before where I've had two brats. So I thought, okay, I'm still hungry after this disaster oversized hot dog thing. I'm going to go try that. I go wait, and the line's a little bit longer, but I go ahead and I stand in it, and I get there, and you can see the onions and the sauerkraut. But then I look at what for them passes as a bratwurst, and I don't know how best to describe. And I know you'll know it when you hear it, but you know these brats were like albino hot dogs. I mean they're just pure white, and they're not grilled particularly well. You know they're I'm not going to say they were cold, but they were undercooked. So you had some sauerkraut and some fried onions doing a good job of masking an otherwise really not good bratwurst, or what they claim to be a bratwurst. So I've learned my lesson, because I have ordered enough old fashions at any given bar that was not in Wisconsin to never do it again. Nobody can make an old-fashioned, almost nobody can make an old-fashioned outside of Wisconsin. If they say they can, and if they do not have a story of directly working in Wisconsin in the past, they are lying to you, and what they will give you is a Manhattan. They think a Manhattan and the old-fashioned are the same thing, when they're not. They're just not. Same can now officially be said for brats at any stadium that is not in the state of Wisconsin. It's just not fair.
See, you're just giving me more reason not to want to leave the state, because that's a terrible excuse for a bratwurst. And if you, I guess, it's just giving me a heads up that if I leave, I got to get a hot dog and just a assume that I'm going to get a hot dog, and you can expect, you get what you expect with a hot dog almost everywhere. I guess you can't say the same when it comes to a brat.
No, my late father had lived in Arizona for 10 years after retirement. And when he first moved there, he had this idea. He never turned it into something. And I still think somebody could do something in Arizona or South Texas, Florida. And that is to have a Wisconsin-themed restaurant where, yeah, it's going to cost more. But by going there, you're going to know that fresh brats, fresh cheese curds were flown in every so often. And, you know, you have all the Packer themes and everything else. You would have Leinenkugels or you know, other Wisconsin beverages there. And, you know, I think it would really catch on with the retirees.
There's one in Denver. There's one in Denver. It's not necessarily a retiree capital, but there is an excellent Wisconsin-themed restaurant and bar in Denver, Colorado. And they do know how to make the old fashions correctly still. So I've
been to Packer bars in many different cities around the country, and those are great. But again, those are bars that have the Packers on TV and some Packer decorations.
No, this is full Wisconsin theme. So
you got to do it. You got to do it all the way, kids. You got to have the brats, and you got to know how to cook them. For the love of God, cook the brat the right way and do an actual brat. It's not that hard. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. You're up north. Oh my goodness, I feel like I'm spinning tunes again on 89.7 FM WUEC from the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. I mean, it was nothing but Genesis albums and Phil Collins, you know, during the light rock afternoon hours. You know what still gets me, thinking back to the college radio station days, and again, this is 1985, 86, is the longevity of some artists. Back then, two of the newest artists emerging bands, Bon Jovi, or U2 and Bon Jovi, were both like relatively, and they're still out there. I mean, you wouldn't have guessed that back then. You just never, you know, you never know right off the top who's going to be the one hit wonder and who's going to have staying power. We're going to talk a bit about some new polling. We talked last week about the new Marquette poll with the usual caveat that, again, polling A is a snapshot at a single moment in time, subject to change, and B will always have some flaws. I want to get one of my big beefs about polling out of the way first, and then we'll see what we can glean from this new one by NBC News. But this poll, like others, Marquette as well, they ask this question: do you believe the state or the country, depending on the poll or whomever, do you believe is on the right track or the wrong track? And this feeds that narrative that often guides midterm elections when they will say, oh, I feel like we're on the wrong track. But they don't ask why. I mean, right now, I would say that even though President Biden has had the biggest string of accomplishments in the first 2 years than any modern American president, I would still probably, if I was responding honestly, say the country's on the wrong track, but it's on the wrong track because of threats to democracy, because of the obstruction of Republicans, because of the undermining of voters' faith. That's what has our country on the wrong track. That needs to be fixed. It's not a comment on Biden. So right track, wrong track, they don't, you need to go deeper and say, why do you feel like we're on the wrong track? If you don't, it again feeds that narrative of, well, it must be the president's fault. Doesn't the president have a magic wand and can fix everything? So having got that out of the way, a clear majority of American voters, according to NBC News, believe that the various investigations into alleged wrongdoing by former President Donald Trump should continue. The poll shows a dissatisfied public, with 3/4 of voters saying the country is headed in the wrong direction, and it all paints a mixed picture of the 2022 midterm landscape. And we've covered that previously in the first hour of our program about how midterms are not They should not be so belittled. It's when we elect a governor in Wisconsin is during these midterms. And so it's important that voters really plug in and don't just vote with a sense of dissatisfaction, but to look and say, why? Why the dissatisfaction? Who or what is standing in the way of you feeling satisfied? So it was curious to me that there is a new number one issue listed as the most important one that the people in this survey think is facing the country. And it's not an economic one. It's not jobs in the economy. That was number three. It's not cost of living. That was number two. Those were easily eclipsed by threats to democracy. And I found that very interesting. But again, in that same right track, wrong track, what are they really saying? I don't doubt for a moment there are plenty of Trump Republicans in there as well who think that there's a threat to democracy, but their idea of the threat to democracy is based on a lie, that there's something wrong with the way voting is done right now. And that's very unfortunate. But I also believe there are more than a few people in that category who have it right, that the threat to democracy is coming from the people who are openly and enthusiastically hostile toward democracy. And for far too long, that was treated with kid gloves by much of the media, because they did not want to believe or could not believe that there would actually be a major political class in America that was hostile to American democracy. But as we talked about in our second hour with Ron Johnson and the laughability that he would say, well, we don't need to protect gay marriage because that ruling's never going to be overturned by the same Supreme Court that just overturned a woman's right to an abortion. So, yeah, there is very definitely a threat to democracy. And we talked last week about how Brian Stelter, media critic, was booted by CNN as they tried to go for a quote-unquote more centrist tone. Again, how can you have a more centrist tone about threats to democracy? Well, also wrapping up their stint as a media critic is Margaret Sullivan, who wrote her final column for The Washington Post and had some things to say about how American media is covering the threats to democracy. She begins by answering that question, quote, "I'm encouraged one day, despairing the next." And then she goes on to note that this next election cycle, frankly, this one and 2024, is a real test for what she calls the reality-based press, or, you know, mainstream media, whatever you would want to call it. She says the good news is that the media has come a long way in figuring out how to cover the democracy-threatening ways of Donald Trump and his allies, including his helpers in right-wing media. It is now common to see headlines and stories that plainly refer to some politicians as election deniers. And again, that's a good thing. If folks are denying the fact of the results of the 2020 election, they are in fact election deniers. And journalists have been far less hesitant to be blunt and use the word lie to describe Trump's false statements. And again, she thinks it's a good thing that when you are knowingly spreading a falsehood, that it is okay to use the word lie. And the media, she says, seems to have finally absorbed what should have been blindingly obvious from the beginning. Trump is by no means a normal public figure, and he will never reform into some kind of responsible statesman. Who can forget, she says, the perennial predictions that Trump was becoming, quote unquote, more presidential simply because he read from a teleprompter instead of veering off on an insulting rant. She's also encouraged by the decision by a number of media organizations to form democracy teams or democracy beats that concentrate on the efforts to limit voter access, politicize election systems, and instill doubt about legitimate voting results. And I would underscore the need for that in Wisconsin is paramount. And again, we have some fantastic journalists in Wisconsin. they do, and they're being nationally recognized. However, there are also a lot of smaller newsrooms across the state that perhaps don't intend to be stenographers, but by doing so little to show an awareness of the threats to democracy, they merely parrot the false points that undermine that democracy that we need and that protects a free and fair press. So news outlets, her main point is this: news outlets really have to scale back on the live coverage of speeches and rallies and some of these political forums or even debates. And that is something that is not going to sit well with any media outlet that is in the business of being able to broadcast live. I mean, that's for them, that's the whole point. And to them, the purest form of news is just pointing a camera at something and saying, look, this is completely unfiltered. There's no anchors or commentators telling you what to think. This is just it. You see it and decide for yourself. No, that's not the best form of journalism. I mean, it's a peephole into something that's, it's a, you know, a time portal that you can look and see Trump speaking at a rally in Arizona without being at the rally in Arizona. But we don't need more unfiltered looks at things that are lies. We need filters more than ever. We need good, solid journalists, anchors, commentators, political reporters, analysts who are either in real time saying, that's a lie, that's a falsehood, that's not quite true, here's the real story. Or more likely, instead of doing that live, is taping it, playing it back right away, as soon as you can, once you have fact-checked, once you have combed through the claims, so that you are not repeating that falsehood. And yes, that's not the same as covering an event live. You can still always go to an event live. You can dip into it. You can show the crowd. You can say so-and-so has started speaking. And afterwards, you know, we will, you know, give you the best of what they had to say. Again, you'll be able to see an unfiltered view online almost any place, whether C-SPAN is covering something or some blogger is covering it and putting it on Facebook Live. Unfiltered views, live views that include falsehoods will still be readily available. But if you want to be a credible newsroom in 2022 and moving forward, you can't be a shill and you can't depend on knee-jerk live coverage. As Margaret Sullivan says here, real-time fact-checking, she writes, is of limited usefulness. Better to wait until these live events have occurred and then present them packaged with plenty of truthful reporting around them. Journalists simply can't allow themselves to be megaphones or stenographers. We need more dedicated truth-tellers using clear language, plenty of context, and thoughtful framing to get the truth across. And she then uses the example that I brought up on the program here Friday, where the difference between how the Associated Press framed a story about something that Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida had to say versus how the New York Times covered it. And in that particular case, the New York Times coverage added that even though DeSantis is saying 17 people have been charged with voter fraud, 11 million Floridians voted, and there is no evidence that election crimes are a serious problem in Florida. You need to have that context, or you're simply an accessory to the spreading of information that does not have context. News organizations should be in the business of explaining to readers, viewers, and listeners, Sullivan says, why they are doing what they are doing. Otherwise, you end up undermining the very democratic system that makes us all possible, as Jonathan Carl from ABC News says in the column. So again, her final column as a media critic is to have less live campaign coverage, more context and thoughtful framing, and more fearless straight talk from news leaders about what's at stake and why politics coverage looks different. The latter can take many forms: editors' notes on stories, columns written by news directors and posted prominently on websites, and more. And even if the reality-based press does a perfect job, it's still no match for the right-wing media ecosystem and its all-in work on behalf of Trump and company. But there is no excuse for not trying our best to stand for democracy and not willingly or unwittingly undermine it. We'll be back. I'm Pat Kreitlow. You're up north.
Wisconsin Conversation, real information. Live from Lake Wissota, this is Up North News with Pat Kreitlow.
Yeah, I don't know. It might have been a mistake to play this because Black Cow from Steely Dan is one of my favorites. And I'm tempted to just let this thing roll and just go refill the coffee cup.
I thought we were looking to fill time. It's a Monday morning.
Goodness knows they can do it. They can do it better than I can. Welcome back. It's Monday morning. This is Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Congratulations to Kristen Bry, whose program follows this one on many fine radio stations across Wisconsin, on getting married over the weekend and on not getting her wedding washed out. I know there was a lot of apprehension, shall we say. There was tagging, begging, and pleading of every Milwaukee meteorologist to do something about it, knowing full well they can't. And I guess, according to one of her later tweets, only got a few drops here and there. So congrats to her and many, 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 many decades of happiness in the happily ever after department. In looking at what's happening in, we've been talking a lot about the Wisconsin Senate race with Ron Johnson and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. And I know what you're saying is that, wait, there's that other big race with Tim Michaels challenging Governor Tony Evers. There isn't nearly as much. Tim Michaels hasn't had nearly as much to say as Ron Johnson lately. I think in large part that is planned. He is certainly not as bad as DeSantis in Florida or Mastriano, the Republican gubernatorial nominee in Pennsylvania, in terms of, you know, outright hostility toward the press and blocking them from events. But I do worry that we're getting closer to that point. And I think there simply needs to be a closer examination of what Tim Michaels would do and whether he is paying lip service to something like democracy or if he would really protect it or be downright hostile to it. He may be as extreme as Mastriano in Pennsylvania, but he needs to be, you know, I don't know that he has answers like these. These are Mastriano's actual questions to a candidate survey. Is global warming real? Mastriano, it is not. It's fake science and it's a racket at the academic level. Should gay marriage be legal? Absolutely not. I'm for traditional marriage. It's been like that for 6,000 years. It was the first institution founded by God in Genesis, and it needs to stay that way. Is Islam compatible with the Constitution? Mastriano, it is not. The Constitution was based on Christian Judeo ideals. No, it wasn't. And it's only compatible with that worldview. Guess what? He says, not all religions are created equal. Should gender identity be added to anti-discrimination laws? Mastriano, absolutely not. That's madness. And finally, should LGBTQ couples be allowed to adopt? Mastriano, no. That's it. Just a single word. No tap dancing around it. This is the extreme candidate that Republican voters chose in their Republican primary. They may have that in Tim Michaels, but if he's not getting asked enough direct questions from the media yet, it's harder for voters to know for sure if this is what we're going to get. Why am I not giving him the benefit of the doubt? Because again, we have the record of Scott Walker, who in 2010 never said anything about removing public employees' rights to bargain collectively. And yet that's the first thing he did. And in 2014, poo-pooed the idea that he would somehow go to more union busting legislation when in fact, one of the very first bills that got rushed through and he signed was so-called right to work legislation that, again, was an attack on union workers. There's just no trust between Republican candidates for governor in Wisconsin and the voters without explicit answers to questions like these and more. So that's why there hasn't been a lot said about the governor's race lately, simply because there hasn't been that level of dialogue with Tim Michaels. So we've been focusing a bit more on the Senate race, in part because Ron Johnson can't help himself, but also because of side stories that affect his race, such as the one that came up late last week about how the National Republican Senatorial Committee, basically the Senate Republicans Campaign Committee, is cutting back big time on spending on ads that would benefit Johnson and Senate Republicans in other states. And there's been more than a little attention focused on the head of the NRSC, and that would be Florida's Senator Rick Scott. Again, a multi-millionaire who had previously served as Florida's governor before winning the election to U.S. Senate. And all of that remains a mystery to me, how he won any election at all when Rick Scott is still on record, I believe, as having pulled off, or oversaw, I guess I should say, the largest Medicare fraud in U.S. history. When he was CEO of Columbia HCA, the hospital company was fined nearly $2 billion for Medicare fraud, for doing things like billing Medicare and Medicaid, meaning you and me, the taxpayers, for tests that were not necessary or had not been ordered by physicians. The company attached fake or false diagnosis codes to patient records to increase reimbursement to hospitals. This is all from PolitiFact, by the way, through the Poynter Institute. The company illegally claimed non-reimbursable marketing and advertising costs as community education. And Columbia billed the government for home health care visits for patients who did not qualify to receive them. And yet somehow, Rick Scott, after that massive fine, was elected governor and then Senate. Now he heads up the National Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee. And now they are retreating, and that has some people very unhappy after that $10 million cancellation, because the NRSC had just been reporting record fundraising that topped $173 million so far in this election cycle, according to disclosures by the Federal Election Commission. But the committee has burned through nearly all of it, apparently, and NRSC's cash on hand has dwindled to under $28 million by the end of June. The committee was committed to spend $23 million more on ads, $21 million more on text messages, $12 million to pay off their American Express credit cards, and more. So I guess it really shouldn't be a surprise that you read tweets like this one that says, "I think it's hilarious that the Republicans put Rick Scott, who holds the record for the biggest Medicare fraud in history, in charge of NRSC's campaign funds. They blew through the money, so the GOP is being forced to pull its Senate campaign ads from all the battleground states." This is the party of fiscal responsibility, I think. Isn't that what they still claim that now and then, don't they?
They would like you to believe that that's what they can go by. But here in Wisconsin, we've known for a while, between Foxconn, paying to not have high-speed rail, and everything like that, the Republicans aren't necessarily the party of fiscal responsibility. But the crazy thing is, I've worked on campaigns in the past, Pat. I'm in that world pretty. I follow the online campaign world a lot for progressive Democratic candidates. Mm-hmm. And one of the line items of that reporting that you just pointed out, the $21 million spent on the text messaging program, as far as I can tell, that's got to be the most expensive text messaging campaign plan, because all of the campaign experts that I follow and know and I've spoken to about this, they say that they wouldn't be able to burn through $21 million for a texting campaign if they needed to do it for years, let alone just the several months left between now and November. So I truly don't know where this money's going, but Rick Scott has a habit of making money disappear.
And if that's all he did, that would be enough. But Rick Scott fancies himself somewhat of a Newt Gingrich type of person who believes you should be forceful and proactive with a campaign plan. And that would be fine. I mean, Newt Gingrich had his contract on America all those years ago, and they fulfilled some of those threats and carried them through. Rick Scott is doing something similar. Now, again, he's not the Senate Republican leader. That's Mitch McConnell. But as head of the Senate Republicans Campaign Committee, he put together his own plan, saying that this is what he feels Senate Republicans should stand for and get done. And Ron Johnson has complimented him on it. He has said, well, there might be one or two things that I wouldn't do, but he won't say what they are. Ron Johnson won't say explicitly what is in the Rick Scott plan that he wouldn't go along with, keeping in mind that the Rick Scott plan is the one that would put Medicare and Social Security and every other federal program up on the chopping block within 5 years. And at each point, Social Security would have to survive a vote. Medicare would have to survive a vote. Apparently things in the Defense Department would have to survive a vote. And that means you're always left to the whims of what the last election was, rather than a long-running national promise. I mean, let's take the military, for example. Imagine if that whole thing was on a two-year budget, that every year or every 2 years with each session of Congress, it could be that we have the number of aircraft carriers we have now, or nope, we don't want aircraft carriers anymore, or something similar. It sounds silly, but it's not. If we've learned already this year with the repeal of Roe v. Wade, there is nothing that is unthinkable or unimaginable. And if you're going to put entire programs up, that is so different than the long-range promises and programs that any government should be making in order to have some uniformity, some security, some credibility. It's one of those reasons why I have never been the world's biggest fan of two-year terms. Some would say, well, that just keeps you accountable. Perhaps, but it also means you're always campaigning. You're always making promises, and yet there's no time to keep them. And the only promises you can make are the short-term kind, rather than saying, you know, we're going to make this, say, long-range investment in something. It means that I'm committing that more than 2 years from now, we're going to continue paying for this thing. But it's important, so we're going to do it. That's what leaders do. That's what long-range thinkers do. Short-range is, you know, if that were the case, nobody would own their own home. Nobody would mortgage. A mortgage is that long-term investment that you make. And you don't have to be, you know, mechanically inclined to, I could never put this thing back on my toilet after I took the fill valve off. Disgusting. I don't know why I still hang on to that. But although, come to think of it, I put the Van Gogh cushion behind me from the immersive art exhibit. Maybe I need to put the toilet valve.
I think it's a wall mount. Yeah, it's almost worthy of a wall mount.
Some people have on them behind the wall, like the people that they interviewed, the guests that they've had. Maybe I just need the props, you know, of house projects and visits and things like that.
I don't think that Coca-Cola Dream World is going to get any better by hanging
I
on
still
the shelf.
Have the bottle in no. case I might change my mind and give it another try. I might.
Third time's the charm.
Yeah, right. Yeah, could put that Coca-Cola bottle up there. My point being, he said, returning back to the main track, is that you have to have leaders in government who make plans for the long run. It's why Social Security has lasted for, 87 years now, Medicare and Medicaid, why we don't have the extreme poverty, illness, and death that we once had in the years of the Depression, was having that kind of long-range thinking. The short term that gives you a Rick Scott also gives you a Rick Scott that by the end, you're not just, you don't have money for the long run, you don't have money for next month. We'll wrap up today's visit after this. You're up north. Wrap things up with mullet talk. We haven't done hairstyles for a while, and I can't continue doing the food talk because it just increases the level of torture here. Anyway, congratulations goes out to Emmett, otherwise known as Mullet Boy, won the kids division of the USA Mullet Championships. I know this is radio, and you probably appreciate a visual. I would like to think if there's ever a time I don't have to give you a visual, it's on describing kids with mullets, the old business in the front, party in the back. And Emmett, age 8, I'm looking at a website here. It's through Gray. So that's TV 13 in Eau Claire and Channel 15 in Madison. And there in Menominee, up here in Dunn County, is 8-year-old Emmett Bailey with his long blonde locks in the back, and of course the Viper shades, just giving that ruddy face even more of a glow that says, "Of course I'm Mullet Boy. What else would you expect?" He got a total of 9,896 votes. In second place was Epic Orta with 8,400, and then William Dale Ramsey with 4,058. Epic. That's an amazing name, and of course you'd expect that in a mullet competition. But yeah, have you been able to look at Emmett
I've
yet?
I've seen Emmett's photo, but also we've got I googled this to find the kids mullet champion Emmett. We also have Wausau West senior Caden Kershaw won the teen national division for the U.S. mullet competition. So yes, Wausau and Menominee, we've gotten two. I'm sorry, I didn't know if you knew that one, so I wanted to share it with you.
Yes, I was just going down the story here that, yes, another gold coming from Wisconsin.
I thought there was only one. See, this is news to me.
No. Caden Kershaw from Wausau won the teens division of the USA Mullet Championship with 3,215 votes. I don't think anything does a better job of personifying that Wisconsin has everything. the state that gave you, Ron Johnson also has given you Tony Evers. The state that gave you Russ Feingold has also given you Ron Johnson and Joe McCarthy and Scott Walker. The state that has given you razor-thin majorities for Democratic presidential candidates gave you a razor thin majority for Donald Trump in 2016. And then again for Joe Biden 4 years later. And I say razor thin because it's clear that a razor was used like never before on the mullets of these kids that allowed them to be part of the, of any mullet competition, much less finalists, much less best in the country.
Champions. They are champion mullet wearers. Purveyors of mullets. I don't know how you necessarily describe somebody in that way, but two, we got the teen and the kids division winners. That's insane.
And by the way, there was one more Wisconsin kid mullet of note, and that was Axel from Brilliant, who was a finalist and finished in fourth place. So, I mean, congratulations.
And Axel's got a promise. I mean, you got to assume that these kids are putting in years to these styles. Like, this is not something they just wake up one day and they're like, I want to compete in this. This is something that these kids have dedicated their look to. And congratulations to them.
Yeah, You know, both my two older grandsons, one turns 16 this week and one is 8. And they once upon a time, you know, had these very nice, clean buzz cuts. But somewhere along the line, the older one decided to let the hair grow out there in the mountains of Idaho. And pretty soon the younger one wanted to follow what Big Brother was doing. And so they both have long blonde hair, and their mother, our older daughter, is a stylist, works in a salon. She is very good at what she does. And those boys always look great. You know, long hair like that would not necessarily have been my choice. I've got my own look that is, well, look, I've had the same hairstyle since 1979, and I'm not even kidding. It was the bowl haircut until eighth or ninth grade. And then I was finally taken to an actual barber shop. I was given this thing with the part on the left, your typical TV anchorman haircut. And I've had it ever since, except for 1 year when we allowed a consultant to give me a different hairstyle. It looked a lot like a bowl cut, and the backlash from the TV 13 viewership around Eau Claire was swift. And less than a month later, that consultant's idea of a haircut was gone. So I think maybe that's part of why my daughter is such a good hairstylist, is she learned from that traumatic mistake. My point being, a mullet is not something that she would do for the boys. There are many ways to have, you know, long hair, to style it, to you know, put some product in it and what have you, without going the route of the mullet. So while, you know, good for these guys, good for Clayton and Axel and everybody else for what you've done, but long hair, however you style it, can get you noticed. Recently, for a time, our daughter and those two boys were living in South Texas, and they were in a school with a large Hispanic community, and made some great friends, lovely kids, lovely families. And it was, you know, it was a great exercise in you know, diversity and culture and what have you, especially when you consider that they had never had in their classes kids, any boys with, the first, there were very few kids with blonde hair to begin with, much less long blonde hair. So imagine the laugh I got when the older one, it turns out he'd been nicknamed by the kids in school, Thor, because they had never seen, it was only in the movies that they had seen a hairstyle like that previously. And I think they teased him with Aquaman as well. And by the way, you can do a lot worse than being compared to Jason Momoa. So,
or Chris Hemsworth for that matter.
or Chris Hemsworth for that matter. So anyway, I think that's great. They're back in Idaho now, ready to start a new school year. And I think they're starting it without a mullet, but I'm going to have to check. Grandpa might have to do some FaceTiming, you know, especially now that the older one, like I said, he turned 16. So what's he going to want to do with that hair next? I don't know. I know he's not going to go with the TV anchorman haircut. He loves his grandpa, but you know, only so many of us can pull off a look like that. I want to thank everybody for playing along with us today. We are going to have guests throughout the coming week here. Looking forward to some really nice visits, but it was fun to look back on this week's headlines. And again, to play, what did Ron Johnson say this time? Parts 1, 2, and 3. Will there be a game tomorrow? Don't bet against it. There's always a microphone near that man. So enjoy the rest of your day. We'll see you back here on Tuesday.